We always begin by acknowledging country and the people who are its custodians. We do this to acknowledge the interconnectedness of all things and to show our respect to Australia's First Peoples. This episode was recorded on the countries of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung and Bunurong Boonwurrung peoples of the Eastern Kulin Nation. I pay my respect to elders past and present and recognise their continuing connection to country and to culture. This is Weekend Birder Podcast, and I'm your birdwatching buddy, Kirsty Costa. Hello, it's nice to chat with you again. If you've been listening along in Season 2, you might have heard Hugh Possingham talk about Australian robins way back in Episode 48. After Hugh's episode, Ben, Harry, Michelle, Rita and Tamara all requested an episode just on the eastern yellow robin. So I've invited Lana Austin to come and chat with us. Lana grew up in a family that loved animals.
My grandparents used to feed rainbow lorikeets off their balcony, raw sugar, out of their hands. So I guess that was like my first interaction with birds. And also, if you're not familiar with rainbow lorikeets, they're honey eaters. So they're a parrot, but they eat nectar. So they're always pepped up with heaps of energy. So they've got these really big personalities. And once they've had a burst of sugar, like they can be quite aggressive and silly and playful. And having that like up and close interactions with rainbow lorikeets was a real joy as a 5-year-old. And then it just flowed on from there. We had pet birds and we'd like rescue birds. And then I ended up with 4 hand-raised cockatiels when I was going through university. I just get birds. You know how some people are like horse people? They see horses and they're like a horse whisperer. I don't get horses, but I get birds.
Lana has been working as a professional ornithologist around the world for many years. In 2019, she decided to return to study and to research the eastern yellow robin. I think I first learned about robins in Golden Books and David Attenborough documentaries, but all of those robins lived in the UK or the USA. So I'm curious to know, are Australian robins the same as the ones that live overseas?
So when the European people arrived in Australia 200 some years ago, they saw robins and they went, hey, these look like our robins in the UK. So we're going to call them robins as well. They're not actually related and they don't even look that similar to me, but I do spend a lot of time in my day looking at robins. If you were out in the bush in Australia, you would describe a robin as maybe like a small fluffy tennis ball with pointy kind of wings when they're perched. And a lot of them are pounce and hunt feeders. So they'll perch on the side of something and they'll fly down to the ground, grab something out of the leaves and then go back up and eat their lunch. They come in lots of different colours in Australia. I just recommend that everyone listen to Hugh's podcast because that'll be really informative. But we have pinks and rose, a couple of different yellow types. Flames, so they're a red colour. We've got red caps, hooded, which are black and white, but they're all really, really cute.
Let's get into the detail of the life of the eastern yellow robin. If you've never seen one before, Lana has a good description for you.
It would fit comfortably in the palm of your hand. So it's not a large bird, but they're not tiny either. Their body is very round. Their back is kind of a slaty grey colour and their wings will be a slaty grey and their tail, slaty grey as well. And then, of course, the star of the show is their breast, which is bright yellow on the front, which goes basically from their beak all the way down to their vent or their bottom. And they've got little whiskers on the sides of their beaks as well. They can be a bit hard to see if you haven't got binoculars, but those little whiskers help them to catch their food and keep track of it when it's in their mouth. Like, oh, is my food moving to the left? Oh, yeah, I'm going to move to the left and keep it in my mouth. Males and females do look the same. The main way that I tell the difference between males and females is I have colour-banded birds. So I know most of my birds by their specific set of colours. So I know how old they are, what sex they are, and also what lineage they are, which I'll talk about in a bit later. You can kind of guess in the field. Normally the boys are a bit noisier. They would do, especially in breeding season, they'll do more territorial calling, but the females can do that as well. So that's more of a gut vibe and not very scientific.
The Eastern Yellow Robin uses a single peeping note, which it puts together into little rhythms like this. It can also make a choo-choo sound like this. Or if it's a bit pissed off or on high alert, it makes this chattering sound like this.
The Eastern Yellow Robin's Latin name is Eopsaltria australis. And Eopsaltria means the dawn singer or the dawn chorus. And it's definitely the first bird that you hear in the dawn chorus. And it's the last one that you'll hear when everyone's going to bed.
You will hear the call of the Eastern Yellow Robin mainly on the coast of Queensland, New South Wales, ACT, Victoria, and a smidge of southeastern South Australia. You'll probably see it too. This robin seems to be as curious about us as we are about it, and it will often come down close to a walking track.
Like I said before, they're a pounce hunter, so they will perch on the side of trees. Normally the trees that they like to perch on are a rough bark tree. I do see them sometimes get a bit confused and they try to perch on a smooth bark tree and they'll just kind of fall off and be like, okay, not that one, I'll try a different one. They'll perch on the side of the tree and along with their whiskers next to their beak, they've also got fairly big round eyes, which is another reason why they're quite cute. So with their big round eyes, they'll look around and scan sort of an open area. They don't like too much grass cover because that makes it quite difficult to hunt. But they don't like it really open either with no leaf litter or no grass because there tends to be less insects there. So they'll perch on the side of the tree and once they see something, they'll fly down quickly and then bring it back up and eat it. If it's something kind of big, they might knock it about a little bit before they eat it. So the things that they take are usually things like caterpillars, grasshoppers, sometimes small lizards. The sites that we work at have a lot of cup moths, which are like a native moth, but they get out of control and they've got these big, spiky, colourful bits on their body. My robins eat a lot of cup moth during the breeding season. They're an open cup nest builder, which means that it doesn't have a roof over their nest. So it's basically just like a little cup that they'll normally put in a fork of a tree, not too high, maybe a meter, 2 meters up, but we've definitely had them as high as 20 meters or higher. They're not excellent nesters. Their nest success rate is not high. They tend to get predated a lot, which is a shame because they are very cute. And we put a lot of effort into trying to find the nests to monitor their success. And then, you know, you turn up one day and they're not there anymore. The male and the female will build the nest. The female does most of the work, though. The boy does a lot of supervising from the side, making sure things are done well. It's made of very fine material, like small sticks and leaves, and then they'll decorate the outside. Depending on the individual, and this is something that I love about robins, they can be very extravagant with their decoration, or they can be very, very bland. And the types of things that they decorate with vary from lichen, so they can be really green and luscious and quite alive. And then other girls use like massive strings of bark that like dangle down like some kind of elegant chandelier or something, which doesn't serve the purpose of hiding their nest. To me, it makes it much more obvious. But, you know, maybe they enjoy the home decorating. I don't know.
Lana is going to have a go at explaining her Eastern Yellow Robin research to us. Let's start with some technical terms so we're all up to speed. It's about to get a little bit sciencey.
When I say the word hybrid, I think the thing that most people would think of first is when a horse and a donkey have a baby. It's called a mule, and mules are infertile. So that concept of two different, genetically different animals having a baby and the baby is less fit than their parents, that's something to keep in mind. The other thing to keep in mind is I think most people, when they think about genes, they think about nuclear genes. You know, when you think of the double helix of a DNA and you think about what codes for your eye color, that's all nuclear genes, which is great. We love the nuclear genes. But there is another set of DNA in every one of your cells and my cells called the mitochondria DNA. And the mitochondria you only get from your mother. Your nuclear genes come from your mum and your dad. So that'll be a combination of their genes to code for your eye color. Whereas the mitochondria is only from your mum. And what the mitochondria does is gives you energy. It's the powerhouse of the cell. With those two things in mind, hybrids tend to be less fit, and the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell and comes just from the mum. That's kind of where my research kicks in.
About a decade ago, someone from Lana's lab at Monash University in Melbourne was doing some research into how the genetics of a community of woodland birds changed based on their location.
They found accidentally kind of this weird trend going on with the eastern yellow robins. And what they found is that robins that were living close to the coast were very distinct in the mitochondria genes compared to ones that were far away from the coast, so more inland birds. And so they found these two lineages of their mitochondria. People in my lab went, okay, that's an interesting story. What's that about? And people did more investigation into that. Since then, there has been an amazing amount of work genetics-wise looking into which particular parts of the genes are different. And what they've found is that these differences on the mitochondria genes and the nuclear genes that work with the mitochondria, they're actually adapted to climate. So that's quite interesting from the perspective of obviously climate change, but also from the perspective of, let's say, we want to do a translocation for an endangered species, or, you know, we want to bring two populations together into a captive breeding program. Do their mitochondria and their nuclear genes talk to each other well, and do they produce energy well? Lots of genetic work has been done to basically say, yep, we're pretty sure that these lineages are adapted to climate. And we're pretty sure that if these two lineages breed, just like our horse and donkey, we're going to have less fit hybrid babies. My job was to go into the field and find out if that was the case, which is challenging for lots of reasons. So basically what I've done for the last 3 years is go into the field, find a lot of robins and color band them. So I know each individual bird. I have a blood sample from each of these birds, so I know what lineage they are. Are they a coastal bird? Are they an inland bird? And then I watch who breeds with who, and then watch how their babies go. While these lineages are quite distinct, one lives on the coast and one lives on the inland of Australia, there is a hybrid zone, so an area 1,500 kilometres long. So it's a very long, skinny hybrid zone that basically goes the whole way up the east coast of Australia, where the inland and the coastal lineages live together. But it's only very skinny.
What a cool job. Lana says that her team is starting to see how their findings could be used to potentially build on knowledge about the survival of other birds, especially as the climate changes. But more time is needed.
Genetics of adapting to climate is so complicated, and genes don't work on their own. There's lots of other things that impact it. If it's a really hot year one year, you're an inland bird, you might do really well. But if it's a really cool year and you're an inland bird, are you going to do well or not, you know? And if an inland bird has a baby with a coastal bird and it's a cool year, what do we do with that information? And I suspect there's some more targeted research out there specifically for how we can conserve birds in climate change. I think the thing that I'm most interested in is it's quite common in captive breeding programs where we don't have a lot of birds left in the wild. Say for orange-bellied parrots, we don't have many. It's like, you know, maybe less than 100 left in the wild. And there's a few in captivity, but their breeding success is much lower than in the wild. I actually don't know where these birds in captivity have come from. But it's possible if some have been taken from the coast and some have been taken from the inland sites and then brought together, that could be an underappreciated way that is causing their reproduction to be less successful in captivity.
That's so interesting to think about. You can hear more about the orange-bellied parrot conservation breeding program in episode 52 with Jenny Gray. A key to the success of the Eastern Yellow Robin Project has been citizen scientists like you and me.
I spent all up about a year and a half in the field, which is a fair chunk of my PhD. We had a field house up in Newstead, which is very close to Castlemaine. So that's about a 2-hour drive from Melbourne. It's a fabulous place for bird watching called Muckleford. If you use eBird, this is a hotspot that you will see on eBird because there is lots and lots of good birds, especially migrants moving through. And we also had a more hot site. So our Muckleford site was more inland focused. And then we had more of a hot site or an inland site just south of Bendigo at Crusoe Reservoir, which is actually another birding hotspot. We had some great community involvement. So basically every field season, I would have up to 6 or 8 volunteers like every day. And then we'd have people help out whenever they could. The community in Castlemaine are incredibly engaged. They love the environment. They just started a new bird life office or whatever it's called. So that was great to just keep in touch with them because they were often out doing a lot of surveys. If anyone saw and took photos, we often got photos emailed to us of colour bands and GPS locations of where our birds had been sighted. Eastern yellow robins are quite territorial. We do expect them to be in the same spot most of the time, but occasionally we lose birds. And so it's really useful. And the community was great at doing that. And definitely at Crusoe, it wasn't necessarily people that we were reaching out to, but just because Crusoe is such a popular birding site, people would just Google, oh, I've seen a colour-banded eastern yellow robin, and we'd get lots of emails from people there as well.
If you'd like to find out more, a link to the Eastern Yellow Robin Project website is in the show notes. In her spare time, Lana loves to go on new adventures and birdwatch in new places. She particularly loves visiting the Mallee, which is an area in northwestern Victoria, near the border with South Australia and New South Wales.
It's a little bit of a trek to get there. It's about 6-7 hours from Melbourne, depending on where you're going, but the birds there are just out of this world, and it's a really special ecosystem because it's only found in Australia. If you're not familiar with Mallee, it's a little bit like the desert, but a bit more diverse and shrubby, and the birds are just great. You'll find the Mallee emu wrens, and I don't know, they're all just fabulous. But I guess a bit more local, Muckleford Conservation Reserve, there's just a lot of good birds. When the eucalypts are in flower, there's so many honey eaters, and I have quite a soft spot for honey eaters.
I've added those two destinations to the Weekend Birder Google map, and a link is in the show notes. Wow, you can tell why Lana is an assistant lecturer at Monash University. She's such a good communicator. Many thanks for lending us your smarts, Lana. I will now look at eastern yellow robins with new eyes. And many thanks to Mark Anderson, who continues to gift us his bird recordings. Hey, before you go, would you mind popping over to Spotify and leaving me a rating? Or tapping on Apple Podcasts to leave a rating and a review? Your feedback means so much to me, and your rating helps other people find this little podcast as well. Thanks so much for your help with this, and speak to you soon.